Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Tonight, a major setback for the former president in the Mar-a-Lago investigation. The special master shut down by judges that Trump himself appointed. Where does the DOJ go from here? Then the wild, multi-hour anti-Semitic rant from the rapper formerly known as Kanye West, while reports of bigoted violence rise across the country. And the journalist awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for standing up to a dictator and fighting fascism with facts is here. What we can learn from Maria Ressa as the 11th hour gets underway on a Thursday night. Good evening once again. I'm Stephanie Ruhle. We begin this evening with that big defeat for the former president and that big win for the rule of law. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled in favor of the Justice Department, shutting down the special master's review of classified documents seized from Mar-a-Lago back in August. Two of the three judges who issued that ruling were appointed by Donald Trump himself. They decided that lower court judge Aileen Cannon, also Trump appointed, was wrong to allow an expert to decide if evidence could be shielded from investigators. And this is just the latest legal blow for the former president. The Supreme Court rejected his earlier bid to intervene in the documents case. And more recently, the justices declined to stop House Democrats from getting his taxes. In another rule of law victory today, Ruby Red Rural Cochise County, Arizona, has been forced to certify its election results after Republicans there had refused to do so. Today was also the day Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee finally decided to delete that nearly two-month-old tweet that just had three words, Kanye, Elon, Trump. And this might be why Trump ally and Holocaust-denying anti-Semite Kanye West, who now wants to be known as Ye, spent much of today wearing a full-face mask and spouting deeply offensive comments on InfoWars, along with white nationalists Nick Fuentes and Alex Jones. Here's just a small sample of the anti-Semitic rant he was on earlier.
Well, I see good things about Hitler also.
Did you hear what he said? The toxic hate speech went on just like that, literally for hours. And remember, just 9 days ago, that man right there, Kanye West and Nick Fuentes, were having dinner with former President Donald Trump at his home in Palm Beach, Mar-a-Lago. Anti-Defamation League Director Jonathan Greenblatt will join me in just a few minutes to talk about that and the alarming rise in anti-Semitism around the country. But this type of bigoted talk is putting even more pressure on guess who? Republican leaders like Kevin McCarthy.
Do you think it's incumbent on other Republicans more broadly to call it out?
Not just Republicans, it should be the entire nation.
He must have a mental issue. No one can believe what he said.
McCarthy was one of several Republicans spotted at the Biden White House tonight for the state dinner honoring French President Emmanuel Macron. Among the many issues on the agenda for this state visit was support for Ukraine in its war with Russia. In a news conference this afternoon with Macron, Biden was asked if he planned to try and negotiate with Vladimir Putin.
I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin if, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet.
Biden and Congress have also avoided what could have been a major domestic crisis, a rail strike that threatened to disrupt the economy and hurt thousands of jobs. NBC's Peter Alexander has more.
A domestic crisis now averted. Late today, the Senate approving a deal to avoid a crippling railroad strike that the White House warned could have single-handedly triggered a recession.
The joint resolution is passed.
The bipartisan bill, the first time in 30 years Congress has intervened to stop a rail strike, will force rail union workers to accept an agreement brokered by the White House months ago, including a 24% pay raise over 5 years, but only a single paid sick day. Right now, workers get none. Some unions rejected the deal because of that.
Meanwhile, there is yet another setback for Joe Biden's plan to forgive student debt. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments for and against the program this coming February. But the ruling blocking the loan relief program remains in place, at least for now. With that, let's get smarter with the help of our lead-off panel, and you're in luck. It's a good one. Jeff Bennett, the new co-anchor of PBS NewsHour, set to take over in January. He also appears as PBS's chief Washington correspondent and an MSNBC political contributor. Luke Broadwater is here, Pulitzer Prize-winning congressional reporter for The New York Times, and former federal prosecutor Renato Mariotti. Renato, it is law night, so you are up first. I want to start with the end of the special master. I want to share what the appeals court said. Quote, the law is clear. We cannot write a rule that allows any subject of a search warrant to block government investigations after the execution of the warrant, nor can we write a rule that allows only former presidents to do so. Renato, can you explain to us what this means for the DOJ and what it means not for the special master, but for the special counsel, Jack Smith?
Well, sure. Jack Smith now does not have his staff, his team, focused on an arduous, complicated, time-consuming special master process. Instead of getting bogged down and supervised by Eileen Cannon and the special master, now the investigators can go forward and do their job. And frankly, that's what the Court of Appeals was saying here, that there's no special pass that the defendant's status or, in this case, the person whose premises were searched, Donald Trump, does not get special treatment just because he's a former president. And so now it's full steam ahead for special.
What happens to all the work the special master had done, Renato?
It not continue. And so what actually happens as far as the investigation is concerned is they get all these admissions and insight into the reasoning by Trump's team. So I actually think it ended up being a net win for the government, although they did expend some time and resources. They got a lot of interesting information about Trump's views and what Trump's team views about, you know, different evidence. You know, do they classify certain things as personal or presidential, and what their arguments are going to be, a preview. And as a practical matter, I don't really think Trump learned much because he already knew what he had at his premises before it was seized by the government.
Here's really why I invited you here tonight, Renato. You told us not long ago that once there's a ruling from the 11th Circuit, which is what we just got, you expected an indictment within months. Is the clock now ticking?
100%. As a matter of fact, I have a vacation planned for later this month, and I'm actually hoping that Mr. Smith takes his time and doesn't do this over the holidays, because I think it is becoming increasingly likely that there's going to be an indictment in this case. And I expect the indictment in this case to come down before any work is completed in the January 6th investigation.
Attention, D.C. reporters, your Christmas vacation may be canceled. You heard it from Renato. Luke, Trump's strategy this whole time has been to make these sweeping claims about executive privilege. Does this now put an end to that?
Well, you know, this very conservative panel of judges really put a piercing shot through those type of arguments, because the opinion actually said that was radical. It was a radical departure to try to treat the president different from other people who are under criminal investigation or have their houses searched because they are suspected of committing crimes. And so along with the ruling that's going on in D.C. with the January 6th investigation, where top lawyers for Donald Trump are being forced to testify before the grand jury and their claims of executive privilege are being thrown out. I do think the types of arguments that Donald Trump has been putting forward try to slow down these dual investigations are being pushed away by various, even very conservative judges. And I do think that it's the focus now is increasingly on Donald Trump and speeding up these investigations now that they're cleared.
Okay, well, I don't have with me my investigations whiteboard, but I wish I did tonight because it's sort of big rule of law night. Some of your colleagues, Luke, are reporting that two of Trump's White House lawyers have now been ordered to testify to a grand jury, and three of his closest aides had to testify today. What do you know about all that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so yes, the very bad night for Donald Trump and his defenses. You have Pat Cipollone, Pat Philbin, who are testifying before the grand jury in D.C. in the January 6th case. They also have a lot of information about the Mar-a-Lago documents case as well. So these are two witnesses who know all about what Donald Trump did or didn't do in both of these cases, and the fact that they are now testifying before the grand jury in D.C., before the January 6th grand jury, is not good for Donald Trump. We saw what Pat Cipollone said before the House committee, and there were multiple times when he was condemning Donald Trump's actions on January 6th, and he was brought right up to the line where he was about to say something more about Donald Trump, and he invoked executive privilege, and the House committee couldn't do anything to force him to testify. Well, now a grand jury is going to hear that testimony because those executive privilege arguments have been ruled out by the judge.
Mr. Bennett, new topic. Let's talk Kanye West. Anti-Semitic, awful, disgusting rant today. And Kevin McCarthy criticized him when he was asked about it. However, Kevin McCarthy has a whole lot of far-right colleagues in his caucus who would like to get committee seats come January. How's he going to walk this line? Where is this all going?
You know, it's a really interesting question, Steph. I will say this, that the Republican Party's big bet on Kanye West today went bust. You can track this back some 4 years ago. I was covering the White House for NBC when then President Donald Trump invited Kanye West into the Oval Office. The two of them holding court across the Resolute desk. And Kanye West at the time was saying objectively false, hurtful, and harmful things about African American. Fast forward to the present moment, he's embraced by folks like Tucker Carlson, by House Republicans. You mentioned that tweet that just got deleted today, but that had remained up for months. Even after Kanye West had waged open war on Jewish Americans, that tweet elevating Donald Trump, Kanye West, and Elon Musk as the three pillars, effectively, of the political right. Today, Kanye West made it really easy for Republicans to disavow him, except for Donald Trump, who has not yet done that, has not yet disavowed Kanye West or Nick Fuentes, the anti-Semite and white supremacist. But go ahead, Steph. I think you're about
to
say
about
something.
What you just said. 4 years ago, he went to the White House and said awful, inflammatory things against the black community. Republicans did nothing. Today, when he said awful, terrible things against the Jewish community, you just said that he made it easy for the Republican Party. They had to say something. Yet they felt no obligation when he said awful things 4 years ago against the black community.
It's an indictment that speaks for itself. Kanye West has for years been a useful idiot for the Republican Party. And today he went too far, it seems. Clearly he went too far. And made himself the pariah that he is. I will add, though, that I hope that this moves beyond Kanye West, because this is about Kanye West, but it actually is about more than that. There are still elements of the Republican Party, figures in the Republican Party, who engage in what is dangerous, coded, anti-Jewish rhetoric. People who attack globalists, quote unquote. People who attack George Soros and his allies. That is dog whistling. And all of it adds to what is the normalization of anti-Semitism in this country. It's dangerous and it's damaging and it's hurtful.
Sure is. Renato, another subject we got to cover. Department of Justice had been investigating Congressman Matt Gaetz for alleged sex trafficking. His dear friend, Florida tax collector Joel Greenberg, was cooperating, helping the DOJ. And his lawyer said that he provided plenty of evidence to help the government.
Mr. Greenberg participated in a series of about 15 proffers, both personally, or in person or in writing. There was about 40 emails with documents, including financial documents, receipts, photographs, and so on. We have Uber receipts. We have Venmo receipts. We have hotel receipts. in terms of the sex prosecution. We also have flight data. And then there's multiple witnesses. There's a lot more witnesses than just the minor and Mr. Greenberg.
So that's the lawyer of the guy who is an associate of Matt Gaetz, who is supposedly working with the government, who is investigating Matt Gaetz. Today, that guy got sentenced to 11 years in prison. How does all of that affect the investigation into Gaetz? Renato?
I have to say the fact that the government went ahead and sentenced Greenberg makes me wonder whether or not they're going to bring a case against Gaetz. In other words, I think that, you know, certainly he got substantial credit for his cooperation. It did result in some cases against others. It's, you know, usually if the government was going to move forward with the prosecution and the trial of Gaetz, they would wait until after that trial to go forward and sentence Greenberg. So unless the judge really forced the government's hand here, I think that this, you know, very well may mean that the government has decided not to go forward with an indictment of Gaetz. Obviously, what his lawyer said sounds like there's a lot of evidence there, and we'll have to wait and see what happens.
But wait, you're saying he got a lot of credit for the help he gave the government, but he still got sentenced 11 years. So what does that say about how bad the stuff he did was?
It was very bad. Look, one thing that I'll just say as somebody who prosecuted a whole wide array of crimes, there's no crime, Stephanie, in my opinion, that is just more dastardly than the sexual exploitation and abuse of minors. It's just, I think the people who do that have a special place in hell reserved for them. And judges and juries routinely agree. And I think the judge here treated his sentence seriously. Even though he helped the government, the behavior he was engaged in was just serious and vile.
Sure was. Thank you all so much for starting us off tonight. Renato Mariotti, Luke Broadwater, and my dear friend Jeff Bennett. Coming up, going far beyond saying the quiet part out loud, we're going to go deeper on the danger surrounding the revolting rhetoric coming from Donald Trump's dinner guest. And later, it is not often we get to talk to a Nobel Peace Prize winner. We're going to get her take on the slow evolution to authoritarianism in other countries and whether we're witnessing the very same thing right here at home. The 11th hour just getting underway on a very serious Thursday night.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
It is hard to know where to start when it comes to this InfoWars conversation that was had today about loving Hitler and Nazis. The interview with the artist formerly known as Kanye West was so shockingly anti-Semitic. Our next guest says even Alex Jones, the Sandy Hook denier, squirmed. We welcome back NBC News senior reporter Ben Collins. He covers disinformation and extremism on the internet. And Jonathan Greenblatt, who unfortunately has been working overtime for the last year, CEO and national director of the Anti-Defamation League. His book is It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Ben, this interview is undeniably vile. Like, you think you couldn't have heard worse things from Alex Jones? And then there was this, that even he had to tell Kanye to dial it back. What shocked you the most after listening to it all?
I mean, just overtly saying the words, I like Hitler and Hitler did some good things. Those are relatively verboten even on InfoWars, even on Alex Jones's show. But, you know, we have reached that breaking point here. Alex Jones even stepped in and said, you know, I don't have anything against Jewish people. I like most, like, you know, most Jewish people are good people and all this stuff. He had to step in and qualify statements from one of his guests on InfoWars. Think about that for a second. This was a deeply hateful interview with every, this isn't dog whistling, every trope that the Nazis pushed about Jewish people in the 2030s. That's where this is at. This was a straight up overt Nazism pushed by Kanye West and very gently pushed back upon from Alex Jones.
I'm afraid to even ask you this question. How's the far right reacting to this, Ben?
So some people are against this. They realize it's a red line for a lot of people. They, you know, for a lot of people, Donald Trump is still an electoral project. And for those people, they realize that they have to get away from this guy. And he is clearly nuclear. This is not a thing you have to align with. But there are obviously parts of 4chan that are very excited about this, saying, you know, he finally did it. He finally brought our talking points without you know, the dog whistles, without alluding to something. He brought them to the forefront. So things we've been saying on the internet, on these anti-Semitic and white supremacist Nazi forums for years. You know, this is coming out of a guy with Grammys mouths. You know, this is coming out of the mouth of a guy who has millions of Twitter followers, who has aligned himself with the GOP overtly. He says he's running for president. So it's a very scary day. And Steph, I really want to say this very quickly. If we don't step up here, this is a problem. Like, this is, you know, if Donald Trump doesn't get this guy away from him, it's going to be a very rough few years here. This is literally Nazism coming out of the mouths of one of the biggest celebrities in the United States.
Jonathan, throughout your whole career, your whole life, did you ever think you would be sitting here right now and having a conversation about a major celebrity publicly saying, I like Hitler?
I mean, Stephanie, to be perfectly honest with you, we've been warning at ADL about the normalization of anti-Semitism for a long time. I've talked with you about it on your show, I think as recently as last week. Well, this is what it looks like. As you said, one of the most popular entertainers in the world telling us that Hitler did some good things. And then, by the way, a few hours later, tweeting out a swastika inside a Jewish star. So Jewish people, if they feel alarmed, it's because they are correct. We are seeing something so destructive, so dangerous. This is as scary as it's been, I think, in memory. And when you have people like Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, the most public anti-Semites in a generation, having an audience, and then again, Twitter openly as a platform allowing them to amplify their intolerance. I mean, in InfoWars, as Ben was saying, this is not exactly 60 Minutes. I mean, this is the place where Pizzagate, this is the place where Sandy Hook, this is the place where 9/11 conspiracies run amok. And yet now, as Ben was saying, what Kanye is doing there is a bridge too far for Alex Jones, who's a long way from, like, you know, Dan Rather or Morley Safer or those icons of journalism. So I am worried. Jewish people are worried. These comments aren't just offensive, okay, Stephanie? They are dangerous. They can lead to real world violence. That's where we are right now.
Jonathan, I saw something crazy. A recent survey found that 1 in 10 respondents don't recall ever even hearing the word Holocaust. How can that even be?
Look, I mean, I think we do need to acknowledge the fact that many Americans probably couldn't name who our vice president is, don't know how many amendments to our Constitution. But, you know, look, the Holocaust isn't ancient history. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. Jews being persecuted isn't ancient history. My wife came to this country as a political refugee. And so when Kanye, and let me just point out something else, no one should be giving Kanye a pass or an excuse saying it's Kanye being Kanye, he has mental illness. Mental illness is not an excuse for anti-Semitism. And the anti-Jewish hate coming at us from all sides, from entertainers, from athletes, from comedians, from entrepreneurs, again, from the former president, I mean, it is beyond alarming. And so I think, again, all of us are just deeply terrified in this moment.
We certainly are. This is a time when we have to step up and stop it. Ben Collins, thank you so much for your reporting. Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you so much for your work. Coming up, Democrats again call up their heavy hitter in Georgia, while the GOP seems to have a Hitler problem. When the 11th hour continues. Yep, that's where we are, America.
So, Georgia, look, I'm not telling you something you don't know. You deserve a senator you can be proud of. Somebody who will talk straight to you. Somebody who will fight for you. Somebody who will garner respect in Washington. Somebody like Reverend Warnock, who's been doing it responsibly and conscientiously and effectively.
On the eve of the last day of early voting in Georgia's Senate runoff, former President Barack Obama is back in Georgia getting out the vote for Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. And the scandals, they keep coming for his Republican opponent, Herschel Walker. The Daily Beast is out today with an extensive on-the-record account from an ex-girlfriend alleging years of mistreatment and violence. NBC has reached out to Walker's campaign for comment. Back with us tonight to discuss Emily Amick, attorney and former counsel to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Her Instagram account, Emily in Your Phone, pulls back the curtain on politics. And Tim Miller, a contributor to The Bulwark and former communications director for Jeb Bush. And of course, an MSNBC contributor and dear friend to this show. Tim, with all that we have learned about this election, with all that we have learned about how unfit for office Herschel Walker is, can you explain to me how this race is this close?
We'll see if it's close, Steph. I guess next week it might not end up being all that close. I think here's why the first round was close. I can explain that to you. Brian Kemp won by almost double digits in the governor's race. And Kemp, for all I think there's some fair criticisms about his policies, did the right thing when it came to the democracy issue, not going along with the Stop the Steal. And I think that garnered a lot of trust from people in Georgia who used to be Republicans. Let's remember, this is Georgia. Barack Obama, as good as he is there on the stump, lost Georgia both times, right? This has been a red state, you know, all the way up until this past election. And so some of that was new voters coming out, people that moved to Atlanta, people that Stacey Abrams had motivated, but a lot of that was former Republicans. And so they went back and voted for Brian Kemp. And when Brian Kemp, when the Republican governor is running by 9 points, you know, he almost carried Herschel across the line. Herschel doesn't have Brian Kemp as his little binky in this one. He's got a runoff. It's a mano a mano against Raphael Warnock. If you look at the early vote numbers, you can overinterpret them, but we're seeing huge turnout among young voters, good turnout among Black voters. And so, you know, we'll see. But I think that it's possible that it ends up being not that close.
Then if Brian Kemp won by almost double digits to theoretically one of the strongest Democratic candidates out there, Stacey Abrams, Emily, how does the Republican Party doing their autopsy not look at that race and say the middle is where we need to get to? Instead, they're going full crazy with the people Kevin McCarthy may look to put on committees.
Well, I'm not sure how much control Republican leadership has over their party, and that's part of the problem. You know, Kevin McCarthy's speakership is a very thin line, so it's to be determined what the fringe of his caucus actually demands for their vote for speaker. But I think what we're going to see is an increasingly slimming power for the speaker in the House, because they are trying to increase their ability to go out and do these big events and do their big investigations and talk a lot about Hunter Biden's laptop. And that's going to further inflame and empower that side of the Republican Party.
Another former president who is not campaigning is Donald Trump. Not only is he dealing with a myriad of legal blows, he and Republicans are now still dealing with the dinner he had last week with Kanye West and the hateful, awful comments said by West today. How bad is all of this for Republicans, Tim?
It's horrible, Steffi. I think sometimes just the Trump years have broke our brains a little bit and makes us, you know, feel like, oh, you know, there's always crazy people having dinner with Donald Trump and et cetera. And so it's hard to tell how much this stuff matters. And if you just try to get yourself into 2014 brain, the notion that a former president of the United States, Barack Obama or George Bush or Bill Clinton, would have met with like a David Duke type person and a celebrity going through a Nazi manic episode is just totally unthinkable. I like nobody would have imagined like that was, that is something that, that could possibly happen. And then for the members of the party of that president to not clearly condemn them, to take days, finally today, Ron Romney went out there and condemned Kanye, but we still haven't heard from, you know, Ron DeSantis, the heir apparent, you know, many other Republican leaders still dancing around this. And it would have been unthinkable. And I do think just looking at this, obviously it's morally repugnant. I think it's a short-term and medium-term problem for the party, but and then also looking at just politically, again, these voters we're talking about in Georgia, these swing voters in Atlanta, they're going to turn out to vote for the Herschel Walker Nazi Trump party? I just don't think they are. And so we saw that in other states throughout the country, and I think that we're going to see it again in Georgia next week.
Democrats are seeing this, Emily, and the Biden administration is said to be eager to let people like Marjorie Taylor Greene become the face of the new GOP. Is that a smart move? Because the Jeb Bushes of the GOP certainly don't want that to be the case.
No. And look, I think, you know, there was a couple stories coming out of midterms. One was the force of young people. One was the force of women. And another was the force of terrible extremist Republican candidates. And that helps Democrats win. And I think it's also a reflection of reality, right? That is where that party is going. Today, I just saw Donald Trump tweeted about the January 6th defendants. And that is really just a flag and a virtue signaling to the QAnon folks, right? He is doubling down on this rhetoric. He's not denying this Nazi rhetoric. He is doubling down.
Doubling down. Remember when the Republican Party said, we're the pro-business, we're the C-suite party? Let me make it clear. There is no Fortune 500 CEO in this country that is going to sign on to any of that garbage. That is certainly not going to help their party. Emily Amick, Tim Miller, thank you both for joining us tonight. I appreciate it. Coming up, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who knows firsthand how to stand up to a dictator. We'll ask how much danger there is here at home. She's seen it firsthand when the 11th hour continues.
Lies laced with anger and hate spread fastest.
As one of the Philippines' most prominent journalists, Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Ressa has witnessed firsthand the rise of authoritarianism and the impact of disinformation and corruption. Her work as a guardian of truth landed her on the cover of Time magazine as the 2018 Person of the Year. It also made her a target of former Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. She has been accused of nearly a dozen criminal charges and faces the potential of life in prison. Maria Ressa joins me now. She is the CEO of digital news site Rappler and was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2021. Her new memoir is How to Stand Up to a Dictator, The Fight for Our Future. But the real reason why I invited her here tonight, she's a graduate of Toms River High School and Princeton, New Jersey. She is a Jersey girl. Maria, I am in awe of your bravery, of all of the work you have done. And we're sitting here in the United States right now, looking at all the things that are happening scared. You have witnessed firsthand the rise of authoritarianism. Do you look at what's happening here and have fears that that could happen here?
It already is, Stephanie. I mean, first, thanks for having me, but just listening to kind of, you know, we heard earlier, you double down. That's exactly the kind of incentive structure our communications, our information ecosystems encourage. And it is not a surprise. That's the behavior we see.
So you've also witnessed what happens when there's dissent against a dictator. We're having things happen here now, squashing speech, don't say gay. Why is that happening and what could it mean?
Well, so look at it this way. It's not particular forms of speech as much as the kind of behavior. And a lot of our work in the Philippines has focused on social media, on essentially what happened after news organizations were replaced as the gatekeepers by technology companies that abdicated responsibility for protecting the public sphere. Instead, what it did was to turn everything upside down by encouraging what spreads fastest and further on social media, lies. Lace it with anger, hate, us against them, and it spreads even further. That's the reward structure that we're living through. So is it a surprise that you get hate speech, that this is the kind of human behavior you're getting? Yes, it impacts politics, but it impacts everything else. So it shifts the type of discourse that we have. It makes people like former President Trump, former President Duterte in the Philippines, people who encourage this type of speech, it gives them a greater megaphone.
But when you talk about holding the line against fascism, with free speech comes this awful speech that's being amplified hyperspeed on social media. So what do you do with that?
Well, the first is actually make sure that this doesn't happen. Because in the end, this comes from a corrosive business model that we didn't even have a name for until 2019, surveillance capitalism. And in order to fix this, in the long term, it's education. In the medium term, it's legislation. We need protection because essentially what this is doing is manipulating our emotions in order to change our worldviews, thinking fast first in order to change how you act in the real world. In the Nobel lecture, I called it a behavior modification system, and we are Pavlov's dogs. This is based on data. In the short term, it becomes a person-to-person defense of democracy. It is hand-to-hand combat on social media to be able to get your messages out. But again, as you can see, if hate gets most of the distribution, then all of us get dragged, get sucked into this, and it creates emergent human behavior.
But Maria, if you're saying the long-term solution is education, the medium-term solution is legislation, let's be honest. We're not getting anything out of the government. And this education you're talking about, people aren't going to school. What are they doing? They're spending their days scrolling through Twitter. And while we're scrolling through Twitter, Twitter is having more and more layoffs, people who were in charge of content moderation. So how dangerous is this moment we're in?
It's become even more dangerous. Strangely enough, it is, you know, we're seeing a nadir of the technology that has controlled and shaped our lives. If you only look at this through political lenses, you're going to miss the fact that our own behavior has shifted, right? The old ideas of name and shame, the way journalists used to work, doesn't work anymore in a day of exponential lies. This isn't the day of Judge Brandeis, where the only way to fight hate speech is more speech. In the age of exponential lies, where information operations, where disinformation is the bullet that information operations uses, and it uses it to pound narratives, people, targets to silence. So this is the kind of, I mean, the quick answer to your question in terms of what do we do right now is the public sphere is corrupted. In the Nobel lecture, I said an atom bomb has exploded, and we must come together to stop the worst of humanity from happening. This happened post-World War II, and this is another one of those moments. The problem with Twitter right now is, without legislation, a powerful man, a powerful rich man, can take over the public sphere, and there's no accountability.
Then when you say we have to come together, who is it that comes together, right? Because right now, you've got one man, Elon Musk, running Twitter. You've got one man, Mark Zuckerberg, running Facebook. And the power they have at this point, it's bigger than any forces that we've had before.
And they've not been elected. And they are determining not just what the public sphere in the United States is, but globally, in countries where institutions are far weaker than the United States. So without this legislation, this is what we have. But the problem, of course, is that they destroyed the system of trust that allowed these companies to grow. What do we do now? Again, you have to go back. Despite the split between the polarization of politics in the United States, legislation has been what we've worked on in the last few years. In spring 2023, the EU, the European Union, mm-hmm. I joke that it is the slowest of the turtles to move, right? But they're coming out with the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act. This isn't about content. It's about algorithms of distribution. A definition of algorithm is opinion in code, right? Matched and then exponentially repeated. So what they're looking at is more transparency in the algorithms of distribution, taking away the ability to actually continue spreading hate, lies. Which upside down world would you encourage your kids to lie and keep lying? This is the consequences of that kind of reward structure.
Maria, thank you so much for being here tonight. We always look for people to help us get smarter, and tonight you certainly did that. Thank you again. Maria's new book, How to Stand Up to a Dictator, The Fight for Our Future. It is a must read. I'm underlining must. Coming up, Ukraine is celebrating Christmas, whether the Russians like it or not, when the 11th hour continues.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
The last thing before we go tonight, Carol of the Bells. With the lighting of the Rockefeller Christmas tree last night, it is officially the holiday season here in New York City. But as we celebrate, we sadly also must realize many cities across Ukraine are having a very different experience this year. A stark reminder of what the holidays looked like just 1 year ago in the city of Mariupol. They went viral today. A drone captured these images of large snow-covered trees, cheerfully decorated with lights and ornaments, houses and trains lit up with elaborate shows. Happy Ukrainians out and about, enjoying their winter wonderland. It is heartbreaking to think about the devastation that was in store for their country just 2 short months later. Mariupol devastated today. We are happy to report, though, that Ukraine's Christmas spirit has absolutely survived. The Shedrick Children's Choir from Kyiv will join several other Ukrainian artists performing this Sunday at New York's Carnegie Hall. In a special program called Notes from Ukraine, proceeds will go towards repairing damaged infrastructure in Ukraine. The concert is also celebrating the 100th anniversary when the popular Ukrainian song, now known as Carol of the Bells, arrived here in America. Originally called Shedrick in Ukrainian, the song is where the choir got its name. And if you cannot make the show on Sunday, don't worry. Yesterday, some very lucky commuters at Grand Central Station got to hear the children's choir sing that song that they're named after. And now you can too. Thank you.
What you heard right there in that beautiful singing was power, faith, and resilience. Our hearts go out to the people of Ukraine this holiday season and every day, along with our hopes for a more peaceful new year. And on that note, I wish you all a very good and peaceful night. From all of our colleagues across the networks of NBC News, thanks for staying up late with us. I will see you at the end of tomorrow.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.